Hello again and welcome to On Mic with Jordan Rich, a podcast all about the voices you hear on radio and TV, the actors, producers, and creators who focus on the most fascinating of instruments, of course, the human voice. Today's guest is a living reminder that the magic that was the golden age of radio, the power of imagination, and the joy of audio is very much with us. He is Jerry Robbins, the co-founder of the Colonial Radio Theater On the Air. Now in its third decade, Colonial Radio, with Jerry at the helm, has produced hundreds of quality productions and audio dramas such as Captain Blood, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, King Solomon Mines, Beacon Hill, to name but a few. How about a sample? Here's a little something from War of the Worlds.
Reinforcements are arriving. Three of them, I think.
Their name is Legion, but they are many.
What are they here for, I wonder? Why come back to the pit?
What was that? What was that?
People. People are falling from the machines.
That hellish noise, what on earth is it?
It's the call to feed.
Eating those people.
Not eating them. It's the blood they want. That's why they've allowed so many of us to live this long. They digest human blood.
Jerry has written, produced, and acted in over 650 productions. His most popular series, the long-running Western Powder River, which we'll talk about during our show today. He's also a screenwriter with several promising scripts being considered, and one of the hardest working and most dedicated people I know who cares about audio and delivers a product that thousands love. Here's another little sample, this one from The Canterville Ghost.
Here he comes, quickly, behind the armor.
Perhaps it was a mistake not to oil these chains, but I cannot. No, I will not be dictated to in my own house. After all, was it not I, Sir Simon de Canterville, who turned the very wig of the Lord Raker white with fear? Those beastly, beastly twins!
All right, mister, that's enough! Put your hands up where I can see them!
But I'm a ghost.
I don't care if you're a ghost or not. Where I come from, when a man points a gun at you, you do what he says.
Well, I shan't.
Well, what a pleasure it is to welcome this guy, Jerry Robbins, to the podcast. We've done radio together at various times, and now we're going to talk about what you're doing currently, if you have the time. Do you have time for me today?
Of course I have time. Of course.
One of the busiest guys ever. Because with the Colonial Radio Players, you're not just playing, you're writing and producing and editing and adding sound effects.
I write a lot of them. I don't write all of them.
Right.
We have some great writers that contribute. I think I'm approaching, or I have done, my 470th script for radio. And we've done almost 700 productions.
Now, this is 2018. It's not 1947. So
That's right.
We haven't gone in the Wayback Machine.
No.
And some would say, how is this possible in an era of video that has been a part of our lives for the last 30 or 40 years? And yet, it's not only possible, but you've made it a success. Tell us about the origin.
Well, it never went away. Radio never went away. It's off the air. Yeah, I think Suspense was the last show in 1960, which was a great horror, you know, mystery show. But there a guy named Jim French in Seattle started doing new radio again in the 70s, and he was actually on the air. And we started in 95, so we're in our 23rd year. And it was very – I just got tired of doing theater. I did a lot of theater, a lot of stage work. And I hate rehearsing. I hate going rehearsing, getting in the car and learning lines. And I had always collected old-time radio shows. And I said, why don't I try one of these? Now, this was before computers and before – what do you call those little things? Digital editing stuff that we use.
Yes.
And I said, I want to do this because this is fun. And I know a lot of talented actors and we could just – how tough can it be? So I started writing them. And what I did was I would get an old Lux Radio theater show like The African Queen. And I would listen to it on a tape deck because that's all you had.
Of course.
And I would type it out on a typewriter. I would type the script.
Literally transcribe it as you're listening to
it. Transcribe it. And then I would have the cast come in, and at that time I'd have to record like one line at a time and get this person over and then edit it all together. And it satisfied my creative need. And after we did about 80 of these, I was getting really good at it. And I'm not kidding. We did 80 total illegal Lux Radio Theater transcriptions, which I've never released. It was just for fun. It was just for fun. Right. And my friend Mark Vandenberg called me up. He's an entrepreneur. And we had known each other for a few years. And he said, you know, these radio plays you do are pretty good. And there's this guy out here in Colorado, and he's making a lot of money on them. And he does stuff. It's not quite like you do. It's got music. It's got sound effects. But it's more narration. And he said, I think we can make money with these. And I said, how? You know, they can't go on the air. I mean, that's crazy, you know. And he said, no, but look at all the gift shops in Boston. And he said, and you know history, so why don't we do something historical and sell it in the gift shops? So I said, it's not a bad idea. So I started writing a show about Lexington and Concord, because both Mark and I were in the 10th Regiment, the British 10th Regiment that does the reenactments on Lexington Green every year. That's how we met. And I wrote this audio drama basically in the style of Orson Welles, because I had transcribed so many of his Campbell's Playhouses.
Yes.
I did the little introduction and we just started doing it. So my shows, a lot of people say, oh, your stuff's kind of old-fashioned, but that's how I trained.
But you weren't born on a turntable as I was in terms of radio, were you?
No.
So you were really an actor. That's your mainstay.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of theater, a lot of stage and some movies and things like that. And for you to go to this genre.
It was easy. I didn't have to do it. I didn't have to worry about costumes. I didn't have to worry about my weight anymore. I didn't have to worry about learning lines. And there was something about taking all these elements and putting them together that was very exciting, to take all these sound effects that you had to – I had to create a lot of them. And then I discovered the BBC library, which was for sale for a lot of money, but you buy it and you can use them professionally. And then I found, oh, the Disney catalog, and oh, the Sony has a catalog. And suddenly we got a library of almost like, what, 2.5 million sound effects that we can pull from. You want a zebra with a head cold in Chicago? Why have the sound effects somewhere?
Absolutely.
And so it was just it was the creative process that I loved. And I never look back. To this day, I don't have a yearning to go on
stage.
It
is such a remarkable company, and you've turned out so many great products. But let's talk about the people you've brought in. And we'll talk about the big name people in a minute, but the local actors who have had a chance to play and to do something that what this podcast celebrates is the human voice. There's so much imagination at play. Tell us about
that. Well, when you have actors that they're really good, and then they're in a play and they're playing that one character. And with what we do, I can get one actor and he can play five roles in the same show, and they're having a ball because they can't do that anywhere else. And they used to do it all the time. You used to do a show. I'm just going to pull a name out of my head, but like Gunsmoke, and you could do an episode of Gunsmoke with 20 speaking roles with six people, and we do that to an extent. Sometimes you can't, but the people that I knew that I had worked with were the first ones to come on board. Then they would have friends, and you know that's how we do it. But they just and then you cast the right roles with the right voices, and I'll call someone up and say, can you do an old man that doesn't sound like a younger guy doing an old man? And then they do it, and it's fine.
Yeah. And how your life must have changed when that digital process came into being. I mean, I remember, as well as you do, you know, cutting and splicing. Yeah. And I mean, we remember those days. Mm-hmm. And when digital came into play, it made everything so much more streamlined. Still work intensive.
But yeah. Different. We used to record on 4-track tape.
Okay.
4 tracks. And I'd have the vocals on 1, sound effects on 2, music on 3, and more sound effects or vocals on 4. And so our original 20 shows that we released or so were mono. We went back and redid all of them later digitally. But I would take that tape and then bring it to a studio, and they would make a digital tape from it. And then that's what would go to the publisher. At that time, we had a publisher. And they would make the cassettes.
Cassettes.
Let's That's
remember
how we started.
What those
and,
were.
And I took those cassettes, the original ones, and I went to every museum in Boston, the old Ironsides Museum. I'd park at the Boston Common garage and walk 20 miles. The old North Church, we were in all the trolley shops, the Constitution Museum. We may still be in their catalog, I'm not sure, Constitution. Mm. But what I found was Plymouth Plantation. We were down in Plymouth Plantation. So I had this whole circuit. But what I realized was that I had to physically go and take the orders because they would never reorder on their own. So once every couple of weeks, I would go out and hit the road and take orders, and then they would sell them out very quickly.
It's almost like the guy who sells pots and pans from the back of his truck.
It's what it was like.
I mean, literally, you develop this amazing catalog, and then something happens, I think in 2005, right, when you go on XM, Sirius XM,
yeah,
around the mid-2000s. Yeah. What happens when the golden age of radio station picks you guys up?
Well, it wasn't book radio then. It was Sonic Theater.
Sonic Theater,
and
right.
they did a lot of modern radio. They still have the old classics station, and we were on the station next door, which was modern radio. And we went on with Powder River, which is our Western series. And none of these shows were designed for broadcast. They had different running times. You know, I might have a 21-minute Powder River. Now they're all 28 minutes or so. But back then, I just never thought we'd be on the radio. Powder River went on, and literally, we had weird times. I think we were on at 3 in the morning and then 6 in the morning and noon on our first schedule, something like that. And right away, everything changed. We started getting emails. Their website lit up. We went from 25 hits a week to about 3,500 hits a day on our website. Mm-hmm. And we started getting emails and letters from truck drivers who loved the show. And I went on a couple of years after this. I went on one of their talk shows, an interview show on XM. And when I was done, I took 10 questions. We were promoting the Gettysburg. We did Gettysburg, and this was the first broadcast of Gettysburg. So I went on to promote it, but every single call was about Powder River. And it really woke me up that, wow, people really listened to us, because the calls I got, I still think about them. You know, one guy said you could go to a truck stop at six at night when Powder River's on. You can wind down your window and every truck's playing it. You can hear it in the parking lot. And
boy, is that nice music to your
ears. I was kind of shocked. And I said to him, I said, well, why do you like it so much? It's because we're driving around all day and then, you know, cars cutting us off and then you come on and you're blowing away the bad guys. And it just makes you feel good, you know? And I'm like, well, I can see that. And another woman, we did a show about a girl in a wheelchair, sort of like an early polio sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And how the Marshall's kid helps her out. And I got a call from a woman that is wheelchair bound, and she had been since she was a kid. And she said that, and I didn't like the episode. I thought it was kind of, we were getting a little too Little House on the Prairie. And to her, it was, she loved it. She could relate to it. So I really learned a lot. And when I signed off, the producer came on and she said they had over 100 calls waiting. And I took 10 of them. And she said they weren't even sure they were going to get 4 or 5 calls. So that's when I realized that the show was popular on XM.
Well, the popularity.
And I don't sound like I'm tooting my own horn. I'm not.
I'll toot the horn for you. The projects that you've done with Colonial Radio and what a run you've had has proven time and again that audio and radio is still a hot medium. People love it. And think about this. We're doing a podcast that people are listening to jogging on a train, in their cars, at home. But it's still the same concept. It's the theater of the mind.
We get kids that listen to us. I get emails from them. One of them is quite angry at me right now because we're a little late delivering season 12 of Powder River. And he's letting me know in no uncertain terms that we're late. But these are kids. And I had another kid that loved we did a zombie show. I kind of fought it. I wasn't really interested in doing a Walking Dead kind of thing. And the writer, it was a comic book, and he finally said something that made me want to do it. He said, "No, but you don't understand." He said, "These zombies are on an ocean liner." And I said, "Okay, that's different."
That's
so
interesting, isn't it?
So we did
Captain
that
Captain Steubing to the rescue.
Yeah, exactly. No shuffleboard on this ship.
So you're also, we should mention this, I mean, the guy behind the scenes, but oftentimes you're appearing in these. So you get to act.
Yeah.
And how much fun is it to really be these characters without, as you say, having to change your makeup and your
costume?
I
wouldn't say it's fun so much until it's done, because when I'm actually doing it, I'm playing a part. But I'm also more – I'm watching the sound levels. I'm listening to things. I'm listening to Mike. I'm listening to stuff in the background that maybe shouldn't be there, someone moving in a chair or something. And, you know, so I'm not as focused as I should be. I don't use an engineer. I do it myself.
Well, here's a question I've asked other actors who do stage and screen work. If they're directing a piece and they're in it, What do they do when they're up there? Do you have someone who's helping you as another ear, or are you having to do it all yourself?
Oh, we have a couple of actors who have directed in the past, and they'll sit there and they'll say, you read the line wrong.
Okay.
You know, you said the wrong word, or you skipped a line, and okay. Mm-hmm. So we do have people that do that. But in terms of performance or directing, no, we don't really.
You have had interplay with a lot of well-known celebrities who have either worked with you or been interested in your work, and one of whom is Walter Koenig, and I was part of that little production. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a little production, my
it
God.
Wasn't it wasn't little. It was huge.
But that was a science fiction piece. He wrote this, right?
Yeah, he wrote the book.
And it was called?
Buck Alice and the Actor Robot.
Okay. Very bizarre title and a bizarre story.
Yes.
And I just remember going to your place in Reading, right?
No, we did it in Ipswich. This one was done in Ipswich because the cast was so big. We used a church in Ipswich.
It was like a church social. I mean, everybody was there.
There was 54 people in the cast.
And there's Walter Koenig, a.k.a. Pavel Chekhov, running around and, you know, giving you tips and wanting this and that and commenting. That was an undertaking.
Walter was amazing. It took him a little bit to adapt to radio because he was, you know, we were in like our third hour on the day and we were still on page 25 of a 200-page script. And he was at a movie pace, which is fine, but we had to hustle things along. So once he got in the groove of it and figured it out, we were good to go. But it was a very surreal moment to be recording. I mean, you were there and you're a Boston legend. And I'm thinking, I got Jordan waiting outside to come on mic. And you and Ken were both out there, Ken Carberry. And I got you guys on hold. And I have Boston radio legends outside in the hallway waiting. And I have a Star Trek legend over here directing. And I'm like, this is too surreal.
We'll be right back to the program in just a moment. I did want to take time to thank you for listening to On Mic with me, Jordan Rich. You'll find links to my website and Facebook page in the show notes. So I invite you to reach out to me. I'd love to hear your ideas for future shows and guests. Since I've heard you take requests, here's one from me. When you get a moment, I'd love for you to rate and review this podcast in all of the important places we hang out, including Apple, Android, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. It'll go a long way in helping me build this audience up and keep the studio humming with interesting content. And now back to On Mic with Jordan Rich. Hey, that's me.
Town is Claremont. All out for Claremont.
Yeah, they heard you.
Good. Train's on time.
Yeah, it's always on time, except on the rare occasions when it might be a little late.
I'm expecting mail from Casper.
Mail car's down yonder, but you can't go pawing through it till I sort it out.
When will that be?
My sorting day starts tomorrow at 10.
Good. I will get my mail tonight in 5 minutes.
That ain't regulation.
Neither is a night in jail.
Who, me?
Yeah.
I ain't done nothing.
You will.
Of all the frame-ups.
Why, hello.
Miss McCoy.
Sheriff Dawes. It's nice to see you again.
I didn't know you were arriving back in town today. How's your sister doing?
Much better, thank you. Jasper, did you get my telegram about the wagon?
Yes, and the wagon's right there.
Oh, wonderful. I have several large boxes in the baggage car. Once they are unloaded, could you see that they are brought over to my shop?
What am I, a delivery man?
The railroad station in Cheyenne, where we changed over, said it was part of the service. That's why I sent the telegram.
No one ever told me.
Yeah, they should have. You get the mail bag while you're at it.
Yeah, the things I gotta do around here. Wish I was back on the trail driving a stagecoach. Now, those were the days.
Poor Jasper.
Oh, poor Jasper, my eye. It's about time you did a little work around here.
You mentioned Lux Radio Theater as one of your early projects to base your work on. And in the old days, as you know, the actors in theater, mainly movies, would go over and take whatever they did. It was adapted for radio, and they would almost always do radio versions of the big films.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy Stewart, Gable, Bogie, all these guys.
Sometimes they do several of them. There was a half-hour Casablanca that I believe Bogart did, and then there was a one-hour Casablanca And oh, I'm not going to remember who did it, who was in the one-hour version. It was someone like Alan Ladd. It might have been Alan Ladd. But so they wouldn't always – the same stars wouldn't. So it was kind of fun in a way where you could hear what would have Liza Bengal Lancer been like with Errol Flynn instead of Gary Cooper.
Because exactly.
You could hear that. You could hear them do it. And it was their way of promoting the movie. And a lot of times a film – a radio show would come out, they would do it, and then they'd do a radio version 5 or 6 years later because the movie was going to be reissued, you know, so they'd do it again. But there was, you know, Campbell's Playhouse would do an hour. That was Orson Welles. Lux would do the hour, but it was not uncommon to see the half-hour version on Screen Guild Players or something.
The annotated shorter version of the piece.
And it's weird because you think, how can you do Casablanca in 30 minutes. But after you hear the show, they cover everything. It's quite amazing.
Well, I imagine that doing what you did, you know, transcribing these, it really gave you a sense of how these things are to be written. Because writing for radio, you're doing a lot of descriptive that covers a lot of that ground, right?
And you don't want to do it obvious. You don't want to say, I'm turning the door handle now. And, you know, you want to sort of slip it in naturally so it doesn't sound, you know, really in your face, obvious that this is radio. And the interesting thing too, Jordan, is if you watch All in the Family, early episodes of All in the Family, all of those writers came from radio. And you could literally turn the picture off and listen to the dialogue in that show, and it just crackles all the way through. Mm. It's a little bit more, you know, racy dialogue for the time that you wouldn't have heard on radio, but it's there.
I even think MASH would be another example of that kind of thing. Larry Geldof, the kind of
and Milt Josephsburg wrote a lot on the Family, and he was an old Jack Benny writer. And those early shows, those early TV shows, they knew how to write. You don't get that kind of dialogue anymore in TV.
Yeah. And the thing I wanted to point out is the fact that the sound mapping and the atmospherics that you create, and now especially with these libraries that you've built up, really are the special effects, but they're not like CGI special effects. Talk about the sound effects that you've created, because you've done a lot of them from scratch called the Foley approach.
A good example is the horses, because we do a Western series called Powder River. It's our most successful series. We did 12 seasons. We stopped taping it. We're going to go back and do specials, you know, 90-minute features. But we did 162 episodes. And when we first started, the horses I would use from sound effects that we bought. BBC had some really good horses. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't do what I needed them to do. I needed to go from a walk into a trot into a gallop. And they didn't have that. They would have, here comes the horse, when he goes by you on the right. They had some steady stuff, but it was not – I mean, Powder River, the horses are very intricate, just as intricate to the characters, to the story as the actors are. So I said, I got to make my own horses. So I said, I'm going to do the coconut thing, you know. So I bought a couple of one coconut, and I – cut it in half, which takes – have you ever done that? It takes hours.
I don't know how island native people survive on just coconut. Maybe they don't, but it's not easy.
It's tough. Yeah. It was the toughest thing I ever had to do. And I cut this thing, and then I get down. I put them on a cement floor, and I get two microphones down, and I do the horse trot. And I'm listening to it, and I said, it sounds like two coconuts. It doesn't sound right. And I'm thinking something's not right here. So I put some gravel and a little bit of sand, and that gave it that grindy sound, but it still wasn't right. And I said, you know what's missing is weight. So I put leather on the outside of it to sort of deaden that hollow sound, and then really pounded those coconuts into the dirt, and it sounded like a horse with two legs. And that's when I realized I got to multi-track this. So I had to multi-track the horses.
A two-legged horse.
So you have the four legs, and it sounds like a real horse. It blew me away. I did this, 14 years ago, and we still use the same Foleys. But we have going up a hill, going down a hill, sliding down a hill. Mm. All these little, you know, the hooves sort of slide to a stop. We did all this. To this day, I can listen to a radio show, and I know they're using two coconuts. You know, it's like –
Well, peeling back the layer and, you know, the old sausage factory line, it's really fascinating to think how they did it in the 30s when they didn't have tape yet. I mean, my goodness.
Oh, they did it all live? It was
all
incredible.
All live.
And Gunsmoke, I guess, had the most advanced sound effects group in the business. They did everything. If you ever see photos from the old Gunsmoke studio, the radio show, it's just the sound effects table is
massive. The William Conrad era?
Yeah.
Do you have a sort of a inner wish project that you'd love to tackle someday, but maybe for legal reasons or it's just so vast? Is there one out there that
There is that we tried. I actually started to write the script and I said, you know, be careful what you wish for. But I really wanted to do an audio drama of Gone with the Wind because the book is so different from the film. They did a great job on the movie. They really – it's one of the greatest classics of all time. But the book is so much more detailed. And I said, how much fun would that be to do Gone with the Wind as an audio drama? It would probably run about 50 or 60 hours.
Mm.
But I really, really thought that could be quite something. But I don't think we'll ever get to it. You might be able to acquire the rights to it. There was an audio recording done in the 70s, but I don't know if I'm up to it anymore.
Since we're sitting here recording, which is obvious, a podcast, which is what I'm loving now, this whole idea of digital stuff that's a radio show that goes to the world. Are you now thinking that that's the next step in your development with Colonial Radio, or are you going to stay the traditional route?
We're going to stay. I tried doing a podcast with J.T. Turner. We did about 50, 60 episodes, and we just talk about what's going on with Colonial. And after a while, it was kind of like, we're kind of searching
for topics. No, but what about a serial or something on
– No, because there's – it's a lot of work for I just don't think we can get the distribution that – I mean, you can, but there's no return for it. It's I don't want to do it for the love of it anymore.
Here's a question that's similar.
That sounds terrible.
No.
No, I mean, it's a – you know, it takes thousands of hours to do these shows and to just put it out on a podcast. I mean, we are on iTunes and all those places.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I do a series and I put the time into writing a script and – or one of our other writers – we have some great writers that work with us – put out a script. I kind of want to see it on a CD or you know, MP3 files, but...
I was going to say, as a follow-up to that, the type of development in delivery systems is rapidly changing. You said CD. It's tough to find a CD player these days.
I know. And we, our publisher stopped releasing our shows on CD in 2013, but they've recently come back because they've had so many people that, especially the older listeners, they won't do downloads.
No.
And there's still a market. It's down 60%, but there's still a market for CDs. MP3s are going to be replaced by streaming.
Right.
And streaming is going to put a lot of artists out of business because you can't survive on it.
The actors you've used, including children, are many of them local actors.
Yeah.
Have any of them gone on to do things in other areas that the public might be aware of?
We have... I don't know if they'd be aware of it, but they're certainly making their mark. We have a couple of kids that had worked with us when they were little, and now they're on national tours with Broadway shows.
That's pretty good.
And who else was we have a little guy that just started. shouldn't say he's a little guy. He is. I call him Kid Dynamite. He's like Mickey Rooney. He just does everything, and he's absolutely brilliant. And he's on a lot of professional stages around town, and that kid's going to go someplace, I'll
but
tell you.
What a terrific venue for an actor, either between gigs or as a gig, because if this were the 1930s or 40s or even 50s, they would have these opportunities. It all dried up after 1960. You've, in this area, brought it back for a lot of people.
Yeah, in New York, a lot of actors on Broadway would do radio shows out of New York during the afternoon or tape it and then have to get to the theater with a 30-minute call, you know.
And wasn't Orson Welles famous for having to go from one network to the next? They used to sometimes have an ambulance screaming along.
Yeah, he'd go from ABC over to NBC and then he'd grab the script before he gets on the air and they'd say, you're playing a rich British aristocrat. And this one, okay. And then boom, just read it cold. And we do a lot of cold readings. We don't rehearse our stuff.
Yeah.
And I trust the actors to get the script and read it over ahead of time and kind of come in prepared with what they want to do. And then we change it. We don't do everything in one take. You know, we'll change things. We'll say, try it this way. Try to do it this way.
Before we let you go, you've had some dealings with another Star Trek legend, William Shatner. I don't know. Well, he laughs. He jokes. He jives. No, seriously. Forget that a lot of the people that are listening to these are also in the business.
Yeah.
And there's interest. What was that project that you were...
He wrote a book called Tech War.
Oh, yeah, I read that.
Yeah. And yeah, I read it too. And we were working with a guy that did comic books. And actually, the guy contacted us and wanted us to do audio versions of his comic books, which we did a number of them. We did Logan's Run and two Logan's Runs. And we did – oh, gosh. Anyway, we did a bunch of them. And William Shatner had said he wanted to do his Tech War as a radio play. I just saw that in the newspaper. And then this company was doing Tech War as an audio play as a comic book. I'm sorry.
Yep.
So – I said to the guy with the comic books, I said, "Well, let Mr. Shatner know that we can do a radio version because I saw he wanted to do, well, I didn't think anything would come of it." And Shatner called Mark Vandenberg, and they had a chat about it, and he was very, very interested. So what I did was I wrote a 5-page demo of the comic book, the Tech War comic book, and we recorded it, and I had Jeff score some music to it, Jeff Gage. So we did the whole thing. So it was our, you know, grade A stuff. We put everything into it, and then we sent it to Shatner. And I'm sitting at my computer one day and get an email that said, "Mr. Shatner would like to speak with you." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, wow, Captain Kirk," you know.
That's pretty.
And so I dialed the number, and I'm sort of on hold. And he, you know, I said, "It's Jerry Robbins for Mr. Shatner," and he said, "Oh, is he expecting a call?" I said, "Yeah." So I'm on hold.
Yep.
And I hear not music, it was just beeps. It was like beep, beep, beep. And I started thinking like I'm in the elevator of the Enterprise going up this big – and I started getting nervous. I was getting nervous. I'm thinking I'm going to talk to Captain Kirk in a second.
And you'll be on the bridge at the time.
I watched Star Trek with my dad when I was 6 years old when it first went on the air. Mm-hmm. So this was a big – I started like – and then this voice comes on. "Hey, Jer." And I didn't think it was him. I said, "Yeah." I said, "This is Jerry Robbins." "Oh, yeah, Jerry." I said, "This is Bill."
Bill.
And I said, "Oh, okay." I knew it was him. And we talked for 45 minutes. We talked. And he loved the demo. And he said, "Well, there's only one problem." He said, the guy playing the lead is too young." And I said, "Well, it's just a demo. You know, I would expect that you were going to play the..." No. He said the guy, he's good, but I said, "Well, I did that. I just read that." "No, really?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "No." I said, "Well, how old are you? What are you, like 19, 20?
Huh.
And I said, "No, I think at the time I was like 55 or something or 52. And he said, "I'm 55. And he says, "Oh, really? Well," he said, "how do you look?" And I said, "About it." I said, I look about 82. Yeah. And he laughed and we had a good time, but... He said he wanted to pursue it, and he said he loved the demo, and he wanted to play the lead guy. And I said, "Well, the problem is," because he wanted to use the images from the comic book as well in the radio play, so it's sort of like a audio comic book. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, if you play the lead, the trouble is the guy that the lead reports to is drawn to look like you."
Oh.
So you'd be using your voice as the guy who doesn't look like you to talk to a guy that – does look like you. I said, and he said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "Well, what do we do with that?" I said, "Well, just use your regular voice for the guy that looks like you, and just, you can change your voice, do a character voice for the other guy." And he said, "Play both roles?" And I said, "Yeah, of course." He said, "Well, people think I'm egotistical enough as it is. I don't know if I want to play two roles in one show," but it's true. But he could definitely do it. He's a good actor.
Yes.
But nothing ever came of it. We just, you know.
But waited. You did have a conversation.
I did, yeah. And,
I think,
and
that's,
it was
so cool.
It was exciting, and
the reason that nothing probably came of it is because he got interested in doing something else.
That's true.
86 years old and never slows down for
a
minute.
Well, the guy that was sort of working in between all this told me. He said, "Don't be surprised." He said, "One day in a few years, you might get a call, and he'll want to know if the scripts are done." Because he said there's no sense of time there. You know,
right,
it's just suddenly like, are we ready to go? But I don't know. But
time-space continuum issues.
Yeah, but we had, you know, I've been lucky. I mean, and working with the Ray Bradbury stories is what really got these people to take us.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I'm so embarrassed that I didn't bring it up. Ray Bradbury, to get that opportunity to get the man himself to be part of that and to offer his blessings. Wow. How did you manage that?
We just fell into it by accident. We a critic actually told us, he reviewed one of our shows and he said, you guys should be with Brilliance Audio. No, not Brilliance. I'm sorry. Blackstone Audio. And I said, I know of them, but they do mostly just audiobooks. I don't think they do audio drama. They did have one guy that did audio drama, but I was not aware of it at the time. He said, well, you should just send the stuff to them anyway. So I know they're looking for stuff. So we sent it. And Mark actually called them and talked to the owner. And he said, no. Nah. I said, well, yeah. I said, you can send it, but I can't talk to you for 6 months because we're building a new studio. And I can't do anything for 6 months. So Mark said, send them a couple of shows. So I sent them, I think, Sleepy Hollow. And I can't remember the other show we sent. I sent them two shows. And 5 days after I sent that, he called and wanted us to sign a contract. So I'm like, great. So we signed a contract. So now we had a real good publisher behind us. And a couple of days after we sent the contract in, he called back and he said, would you like to work with Ray Bradbury? He said, Ray needs someone to do one of his shows. He wants to do an audio drama. And I'm like, oh my God, you picked me off the floor. So we said, sure. So suddenly, within a month of all this, from the time the critic says, you know, send it to the time we do it, within that same month, we're suddenly talking with Ray Bradbury about a project. And we did Dandelion Wine with him. And it was the funniest thing because it was different from the book, very different from the book. It was very Twilight Zone. The book is a great homage to the 1920s living in a small town, like Meet Me in St. Louis without the music, you know? Mm-hmm. His radio drama was very dark and very different. And it was himself as an older guy going back and walking through and interacting with his family who didn't know he was this little kid from the future.
Mm.
And I said, boy, we're going to get kicked for this because this is not the book. And he said, no, you're going to get kicked for this because it's not the book. And I said to him, I said, why would you change it? Why don't we just do the book? He said, because I already wrote the book. He said, the book was 50 years ago. This is now. And this guy always looked to the future. Even when he would sign an email or sign a letter to you, instead of saying best regards, he'd just write forward. No, onward. He'd write onward.
I remember interviewing Ray Bradbury a year or two before he passed away, and he was totally deaf at that point.
Yeah, he was.
So what we did was I worked with his daughter. I sent in questions in advance.
Alexandria.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I never would do that with a guest, but it's Ray Bradbury, so you do it. And he was brilliant. He was wonderful. He answered everything. And I just edited in my questions afterwards because he wouldn't have been able to hear me.
Yeah.
So we communicated that way. And you're rubbing up against a legend of stature.
When we sent him Dandelion Wine, which was a tough show to do because we had just come off of Captain Blood and I was editing at that time. Dandelion Wine's the last show I personally edited. And that was, 12 years ago. Mm. But it was tough to do because it was like, well, we have to set up a porch swing, a swing on a porch. I'm like, what does that sound like? I don't know what that – I've never had one. So it was a tough show. That sounds silly. But really, when you sit down, you have to set up a porch swing. What do you use, you know, from the 1920s? So it took a long time to do this show. And I sent it to him. And that was – I was so nervous because he's either going to like this or he's going to hate it. And he sent me an email and he said he had tears in his eyes. He said, you did it. And he said – he said, you didn't put your own slant in it. He said, you did my story. And this is a guy that Hollywood always would change everything.
You know,
he hated Something Wicked This Way Comes. Same email, he says, so do you want to do Something Wicked This Way Comes? And I wrote back and I said, yeah, sure. And within minutes, he sent me the script.
Wow. We could spend all day with stories like that, but though you just dropped some names that are pretty impressive. And I'm going to suggest that, you know, you're a creative dynamo. You said you edited the last one about 12 years ago.
Yeah, I have some great editors who work with us now.
So you've developed this stable, much like a Hollywood studio, a stable of people,
somewhat,
actors.
I guess you could say that.
It is. No, I mean, that's why I think it's such a cool thing. So it's colonialradio.com for people to learn more, downloads and all that kind of stuff. And if they're in the area, they can certainly get in touch with you via email
There's contact info.
Did you ever have productions where you invite people in as audience members?
No.
You always do it in a studio. Clean.
We did some live shows that we took on tour for Christmas. We played a lot of opera houses and theaters up the coast. And but it's not – everything we do is in post. It would be boring for people to come in and
That's
watch.
That's true. That's true.
Because there's no sound effects.
Well, it would
there's
be boring no for most people. I would not find it boring because, you know –
You'd be working if you were there. I'd have you on mic.
Geek of the first order.
Yeah.
Jerry, thank you so much. It's great to see you. You just keep plugging along with some great creative content, and I thank you for sharing a bit of it.
Well, thank
with
you.
Us.
It's good to see you behind the mic again.
It's lovely to be behind the mic. A mic is a mic. It doesn't matter. And now I know when I'm hearing coconuts.
Yes. Always, you can tell there's two or if there's four.
Jerry Robbins, ColonialRadio.com. You've been listening to On Mic with Jordan Rich, a podcast produced by Chart Productions. Just click the Jordan Rich podcast link at chartproductions.com for more. Please subscribe, download, rate, and review us on Apple and any other podcast platform. Hey, it's great to be with you as always. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific day.